When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you fully commit to this land, you become fully American. But if you don't, you're just a wandering ghost living between two worlds forever.
Welcome to HBO's The Sympathizer podcast, where we'll be debriefing and decoding the new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, which is based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. I'm Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture. And on this podcast, I'll be joined by The Sympathizer's creators, the cast and crew, and of course, author Viet Thanh Nguyen. After every episode, we'll go deeper into the characters, their motives, and how this espionage thriller slash cross-cultural satire complicates what we know about the Vietnam War, aka the American War in Vietnam, and its depiction in U.S. pop culture today. Looking at you, Hollywood. We've got a full house today. We're talking episode 3, titled Love It or Leave It, with Academy Award-winning actor and executive producer Robert Downey Jr. and our captain, Hua Shande. We'll be joined by prosthetic designer Vincent Van Dyke, who did the amazing work of transforming Robert Downey Jr. into multiple characters. And finally, we'll have the sympathizer author Viet Thanh Nguyen and executive producer slash co-showrunner Don McKellar back in the studio to zoom us out a little bit and talk about the big picture, as well as about Viet's cameo in this episode. Get it, Viet? But first, a spoiler alert. If you haven't watched episode 3, now's the time. Go and watch it right now, streaming exclusively on Max. We'll still be here whenever you get back. All right, it's time again for a recap and a little bit of history. In this episode, the captain and his compatriots gather at a banquet hall for a multi-course meal to celebrate the 80th birthday of the major's mother, a milestone lifetime accomplishment for what's known in Vietnamese as a Lễ Mừng Thượng Thọ. Fun fact, the actress who plays the major's mother, Kiều Trinh, a former refugee herself, is one of the most well-renowned faces and figures in the Vietnamese diaspora, her career spanning over 70 years in both Vietnamese and American cinema. At the party, Miss Mori, the captain's date, walks in on his arm and surveys the fancy banquet scene.
Are you sure you guys are refugees?
You know Asian families.
As the early waves of Vietnamese refugees resettled and leveraged their existing connections with their former U.S. military contacts, ethnic enclaves began to emerge as places where people could build community, retain their culture, and explore financial opportunities for upward mobility in America. Back to the story. At the party, the general urges the captain to find proof of the major's guilt, and we meet the congressman, Napalm Ned himself, who rouses the crowd with a speech.
Vietnam, Mon Nam. Vietnam, Mon Nam. Vietnam, Mon Nam. Communism never wins. Capitalism will triumph.
Vietnam, Mon Nam. Vietnam, Mon Nam.
Over the course of the episode, the captain recounts to the commandant his role in the death of another comrade, the watchman, who died by egg-induced suicide.
Why put it off?
Why wait until the Americans have electrocuted your balls with 1,000 volts? You know the CIA's nickname for a prisoner's penis that's been through that process? The electric eel.
Disguised as a blonde-haired white man on the 4th of July, the captain kills the major and makes his murder look like it was a xenophobic hate crime. He leaves a bumper sticker on his chest, the one that the major had given him earlier. It reads, America, love it or leave it. Compassion fatigue and American guilt went hand in hand with xenophobia in the United States, and it continued to persist in the public opinion around Vietnamese Americans. From 76 to 77, not long after the moment in time when the Major's murder takes place, America denied admission to refugees, except for those who were seeking family reunification, forcing many others to find different pathways to freedom. The result was an international humanitarian crisis that would later compel the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, to create the Orderly Departure Program, which is how my parents ended up being able to migrate to the United States in 1988. Back in the episode, the captain attends one more dinner. Claude introduces him to his next mission at a steakhouse where Professor Hammer, the congressman, and the auteur ask for his help on a film that the four patriarchs are collaborating on, The Hamlet.
Captain, we were hoping you'd help us.
By helping his new movie.
To ensure its cultural integrity.
Yeah, what he said.
Act as an interpreter of sorts, a mediator between the two worlds, Oriental and Occidental.
The general speaks so highly of you, Captain, you know. The half and half will give 100% to do whatever is necessary.
Right now, what seems necessary is to demand an apology for the insult I just received.
Cool you just, kid. There's no apology coming. But I am going to give you the opportunity of your fucking life.
I'll take an opportunity over an apology 8 days a week.
Now that we're all caught up, let's get into it. Our first two guests today are Hua Shande and Robert Downey Jr. In The Sympathizer, Hua Shande plays our protagonist, the captain. And Robert Downey Jr. plays multiple characters. Claude, Professor Hammer, the congressman, the auteur, you know, all the white guys. And I'm really hyped to talk to them both today. Hua Shande and Robert Downey Jr., do y'all both remember the first time that you met and the first scene that you did together?
Yeah, that was when I was asking out Sandra to go to the Major's wife's 80th, and then Claude pops along.
I appear disguised. Claude is not his usual self. He is he's trying to blend in. And he's walking a little puppy. Mm. I remember that day because I wasn't sure about the voice. Nobody was 100% sure about the makeup yet. And you'd already been at it for a couple weeks. And there's all these relationships developing. You never, you know.
Yeah.
I'm actually really glad that you got to see me when I was kind of like, I don't know, does this work?
Yeah.
You were not alone, my brother.
And Robert, what was it like for you to work with the star of The Sympathizer in Hua? What felt most fulfilling to see the growth, his growth as an actor from your perspective?
Well, first of all, as an exec, I had seen all of the screen tests and I had seen the development essentially of Hua's take on the character before he was even cast. And it's so difficult. Like, I almost feel like no one should ever really be cast based on these screen tests and readings because it's such a pressure cooker. Mm. You know, just give someone the job and then if they're wrong, fire them. But, you know, that wouldn't work out so well if I was running all the studios. Be a lot of lawsuits. What I saw was very much someone that I could relate to as trained differently than I was, more formally trained, but having worked enough to be ready to take on a role as difficult as this. And sometimes others see in us that which we can't see in ourselves. And Director Park and Susan and myself and Dominic Keller and everyone, we were like, yeah, he's the guy. And then, you know, you want to make good. So what I saw was someone who, again, and I've been saying this probably way too often lately, but I saw kind of a star-making role happen. And having been around for a few of those on both sides of it, it's kind of undeniable when you witness it.
Thanks, man.
Well, it's true, dude. You earned it.
Really appreciate it. But like a part of that I felt was just the environment that you allowed me to work and create in, you know. I felt the pressure and I felt I had to step up to the level of a lot of you guys, you know, Park, Sandra, and you. And, you know, for a good couple of weeks, I was obviously just really nervous and insecure about whether I was even, you know, imposter syndrome. But, you know, a lot of the times I would do something and say something and you would look at me and you'd just be like, are you happy with that? You don't seem happy with that. You know, let's do it again. Let's do it again till you're happy. And I really appreciated that because sometimes you don't know, but I guess you allowed me the space to keep going until I was confident with that. And that's, you know, confident inducing. And that allows you to just do other things and know that other people have your back, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And look, you know, if there's ever been a time where imposter syndrome was appropriate for a role.
So I kinda, it makes sense. In a spy note, yeah.
It wouldn't have mattered if it had stayed around a little bit through the whole shoot. But anyway, well done, brother.
Oh, thanks, Rob. I really enjoyed your characters, though. Like every character that I met, I'd be like, I'd walk up to you and I'd be like, hey, Rob, but you'd be already in your character. And I'd be like, oh, shit, what? Hang on, what's, what version of Rob is it today?
Except when we had lunch. We had lunches fairly often when Hua wasn't being torn away to go shoot five scenes while everyone else was having lunch. And it was an odd sight.
Yeah. Because you were like half dressed down or like half dressed up. And
exactly. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite iteration of Robert's character as Hua? Like one that you felt particularly close to or comfortable with?
You know, I actually felt really close to the professor. Like, weirdly. I mean, he is my mentor in the show. Like, he's the captain's mentor. And obviously, we're very close because he's, you know, like, raised me in a certain way in America in terms of the backstory. But the professor, who I'm sure the audience is going to come to love, is hilarious. Like...
Well, also, like the captain, he's the one who, without giving too much away, is not everything he purports himself to be. Right. So in a strange way, he's a bit of a shadow mirror for the captain, though the captain doesn't find it out all that quickly because he's got a lot of other complications going on. Mm. Oh, but I do miss you so.
Hua, do you have an impersonation of the professor for us?
I'm not gonna try.
with their true Australian accent coming out too on the podcast.
Oh yeah, I it's funny because like I spent so long in the just staying in the accent on set every day, even doing my groceries. I just stayed in it because I wanted to not slip. And when I do these interviews and I do these, you know, talks and stuff like that, I kind of just have to remind myself what I actually sound like. And Robert, you probably haven't even heard me speak this long as an Australian.
I love it, dude. Yeah. I love it. It's so
It sounds so weird to me because like I'm so used to talking to you with this faux American accent like that I've concocted in my own head. You know?
No, and by the way, very, very convincing. That's the crazy thing. It suspended my disbelief that you weren't, you know, from, I don't know, from America.
So, yeah, yeah.
But I like this too. And if you think about it, just go back.
Yeah.
A Australian national playing a Vietnamese double agent who has approximated an American English accent, but then also speaks Northern and Southern dialects of his mother tongue, Vietnamese.
Right.
You want to talk about just things that will give you shivers just getting out of bed in the morning?
Yeah.
I mean, dude. It cannot be underestimated. Just what a mind fuck it was doing this part.
Definitely for the first couple of weeks, I was not dreading, not fretting, but definitely just like, you know, sucking it up and being like, I hope I have it to get, you know, I have it, hope I have it pulled together today.
Episode 103, I think really is, and tell me what you think, where I really think it all starts to gel and you're kind of figuring out the captain's journey, there's surprises, and you know, the episodes almost always end with the introducing a new issue or opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, after the assassination and, you know, the beauty of meeting all your characters.
In the final scene.
Yeah, in the final scene.
Around the country club table.
Yeah. And like, that was such a brain explosion to do because, you know, I feel like I built a relationship with each of your characters in a very personal way. And I tried to, every time I'd see you in your characters, I'd be like, I'd have to remind myself, okay, this is my mentor. This is the antagonist. This is the person I'm trying to shield myself from. And then there's the other person that, you know, I have no idea who he is and what he does. And I'm trying to figure out. And then I'm seeing them all at the same time at the table. And I'm like, hang on, like, who do I like and who don't I like? And there's just like the different,
I want to ask you too, Hua. I mean, how, for our captain, does he really love America more than he wants to admit? You know, what's his relationship with America, which I think each of Robert's characters represent a part of.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't necessarily think it's one or the other. It's always, you know, even in our own selves, you know, we have different influences and ideologies and things that build our beliefs, morals. And so I think when he lived in the States in America, you know, he built a different set of beliefs and that built onto his, you know, childhood. And he married that into who he is as a person. And that's the confliction. It's just like, is it this or that, or why can't it be both? And so does he lean into America? Does he like America? Of course he does, but it's not, that doesn't mean he likes it more than who he is, you know, as a Vietnamese.
Right.
Yeah.
And Robert, you're Claude, right before they go to that dinner, Claude instructs the captain to be quintessentially Vietnamese. So, I mean, what was your relationship like with Vietnamese-ness and Vietnamese America?
Well, one of the great outcomes of diving headfirst into this project was this ongoing dialogue with our own self-limiting beliefs based on our expectations and our culture. And I think naturally coming out of Oppenheimer, it's kind of this college course continues, looking at having literally been raised in the Vietnam era and then finally being shown the other side of the coin, forced perspective into what would it be like if everything was from the point of view of what you consider the other. And I think it's very timely. And I think that it's great that I just genuinely love Hua and I love the character he's playing. And I love the opportunity in the novel and in the rendering of it in this series to have that mirror, hold up that mirror and say, wow, like we're so conditioned to think of things a certain way. So I found it very liberating. Really, I was just trying to kind of like have fun and not get in the way of this important story. And also, you know, with my wife producing it, a lot of it was just trying to, you know, show her that I could be a good team player and try to keep the morale up. Is a very, very, by any metric, an extremely difficult shoot.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I just agree. It was very difficult. It was just challenging, just the straight days, I guess, that we had. And, you know, you sat in the makeup chair on that particular day for the final scene, like for hours for each character. You know, we'd do the scene and you'd be in the makeup chair for 2 hours to do the thing. We'd shoot it for an hour. You'd be back in the makeup chair, pulling it all back for 2 hours and putting the next thing on for the next 2 hours and then coming back to shooting the same scene as a different character. And it was, yeah.
Well, and it was very humanizing too. And I was going to not say this, but you know, Director Park is kind of like a big brother. You know, you want to make him happy, but you kind of just know that he's a better baseball player than you. So there was one moment where he comes in and the translation is, Robert, you're doing the congressman a little bit too much like Claude, or Claude a little bit too much like the congressman. And I felt a little rush of shame, like, oh, I kind of had lost my professional perspective. And I was like, so what? He's the director. It's his job to keep. And he didn't even seem to mind. He was just reminding me that I was kind of coloring outside the lines and that what I was doing wasn't really what we'd agreed this character would do. And I just reset and I looked over and I could tell, I was like, all right, I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
I was getting notes. Because, you know, Director Park, he'll give you some notes.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll feel with certain directors, those notes tend to constrict me further and further over time. But with Director Park, and particularly in this scene, he had done me and Hua a huge favor, and that this scene could have been a week-long nightmare. Instead, it was two very efficient, full French hour days for me. Mm. And we wound up having fun. I think we were a little giddy by the end of day two, but you know, it was critical that this scene work. And I honestly credit the boss with this one.
And of course, it must have been difficult to work across different languages, at least three at any given moment in time. And with all the dialects that are a part of each of those, the dialects and the accents, right? I want to ask about what that process was like to get notes. You know, we had heard, I think, Hua, in another interview that we did for the podcast,
yeah,
you talked about how it was like almost like a roulette process, right? Getting notes from
Director
Park.
Yeah.
And the anticipation, Yeah.
He's got his translator, Jae-hun, and, you know, he when he's trying to give you a quick note, he'll send Jae-hun out, and, you know, Jae-hun is, like, literally walking out to set, and it's, when you see him, you're just like, okay, who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? Who's going to be? Yeah. And then he stops in front of you, and it's you. And, the roulette wheel has landed on you. Park's just very specific. He's very, you know, detail oriented. And if you're not hitting the things that he's in the music that he's playing, you know what I mean? He will correct it. But obviously it works for the visuals that he's trying to get from the scene. And sometimes you just get carried away.
It's very specific. And I find it comforting.
Yeah.
I like it when someone in their approach is consistent. I like it when I can tell they're completely in command of what they're creating and witnessing. And the other thing is, you know, more than any other director, tell me if you agree or not, Hua, is he will rehearse things multiple times in a row. So by the time you're shooting, you're not really working out the kinks. You can get to this more refined space.
Yeah.
And I found it kind of liberating because, A, you just get in the habit of being an actor.
Yeah.
Just rehearsing.
Yeah.
You get synchronized with your castmates and synchronized with the set and the props and the flow. I mean, particularly in some of these more complicated scenes, you know, like the Only the Spy, or No Spy. Like, I remember that whole day felt like a tight little piece of composed chamber music.
It was a dance. Like, he had the steps in his head. And he was trying to elicit the steps for us. And it's just like getting us into the habit of like, this is the moment where you need to do this thing, pick up the thing and move this way. And by the time he's choreographed this thing and you've stepped into those moments, it's just like action and you're doing it because you've rehearsed it so many times in a very specific way.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then there'd be variety too, because, you know, a great dancer can improve and mix up the steps. And that's really what a park is. The way he conducts, it really is. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
So now we're going to do a little bit of musical chairs. We'll be keeping Robert Downey Jr. here with us. Say goodbye to Hua. Bye, Hua. And hello to prosthetic designer Vincent van Dyck. I'm excited to talk with him and Robert Downey Jr. today about the process of transforming Robert into the characters of Claude, Professor Hammer, the Congressman, and the Autor. My first question for you both is, how did y'all meet each other and get on this project together?
Well, I'm glad you brought this up. It's a funny one. And once, if you're lucky, about once a decade or so, you wind up making an association that you intend to keep over time. I met Vincent. I had gone in to get something done for a project that wound up not happening. And while I was there, I said, hey, I wonder if you would be good for, we're doing this thing called The Sympathizer, and this is a great book and Viet and all this stuff and these characters. And he basically said that he would definitely not be the right guy to do it and that we should look elsewhere. And I'd never had that kind of short sell seem so sincere, even though as you get to know him more, you'll realize that he's quite a trickster. And, you know, I pitched Vincent, like hard pitched him, like, this is the guy for it. And all I knew was like, I liked him. And
obviously, if he could deliver.
Yeah. I wouldn't even say that it was wondering whether you could deliver, but it's that thing when you have a gut about someone, you just hope that it winds up working out and that everybody's happy. And there was a moment too where I knew that we had arrived at the right partnership for a project like this. As Director Park came to Vincent's studio, I was there, some other department heads were there, and he had essentially clay molded a beginning conversation starter for every character. And with the exception of Claude, who just wound up going with a bit of a different, it was so already in the ballpark. And also, I've been around a long time. I had never seen someone literally clay mold that many heads to discuss how to execute them. And it wound up being the beginning of this kind of really fruitful participatory, very kind of egalitarian discussion. And while Director Park would make a note or a suggestion, Vincent would go over and just kind of work on it, literally just manipulate these busts. And it just felt kind of like a return to the roots of how these sorts of things were probably done from the beginning.
Vincent, for your research process and before even making these busts, what was that like for you? You probably had the script at this point. Had you read the book? What was that research process like?
First, I'll say, just to touch on what Robert was talking about, that was also, by the way, the first time I'd ever done anything like that. I've never just opened with, here's all these busts that we're going to do live note, session with in person right now. It almost felt forced because there was not a lot of time. And I knew that it was probably the only opportunity that I would have all the voices in the room at the same time. And I thought, you know what, if I can just make these notes happen now, live, then there's no emails back and forth for 3 weeks. They leave, they see what this is, I know what it is, and then we can hit the ground running. So it really evolved really organically and naturally, but yeah, not something that I had ever done before. As far as the research goes, I'm pretty weird when it comes to this kind of work that I do. I like to almost go into it completely blind. I don't really want to be influenced by anybody else's thoughts or my own thoughts. I want to hear just from the voices that really matter what their vision is, and then dive into what it is I think it should be. But I often find that if I read or do too much research, it almost clouds that natural creativity that just happens. So very little preparation, actually.
Right. Had you read the book before creating the busts?
No, I started at the same time. So literally this happened within, I feel like 2 weeks of that first meeting. It was fast. So I started audiobook with the work while I was doing it, and just kind of continued that through the whole process of the job.
Wow. Yeah, my next question is going to be for you, Robert. I mean, maybe taking a step back, how did these characters unfold? Or like, what was that collaborative process to create each of the characters like?
Well, first off, when Director Park had the idea to say, how would Robert feel about multiple roles? In fact, all of these Caucasian archetypes, I was like, wow, dude, that's such it's a great creative idea. B, it's such a smart hook for somebody who wants a challenge. And so again, you know, I'm not like Mr. Method, and I think Vincent would agree. I had a sense. It was almost like I had an associative idea that Claude should be a little bit, you know, fill in the blanks. And then the same and the same and the same. And as any one of them started to come into focus, it helped the others because you realized that you just wanted contrast. So it's that weird thing. It was felt more like finger painting than, you know, paint by numbers.
I think that's it. And I think because we tend to speak the same language, it is easier for me to decipher and understand, I think, where Robert's headspace was at. So whether it's me subconsciously channeling that or we just were on the same page, I think as these sculptures started to take shape, the character starts to develop. It's one of the reasons why I don't do that research, is because there's something, not to get all magical, but there is something magical that happens when clay gets put onto an actor's head cast, or it starts to take shape on its own. And so these characters start to develop, and yes, I'm manipulating it, I'm having these thoughts and I'm having these ideas, but sometimes stuff just tends to work, and that's how these start to develop.
And you can feel it, to literally feel it. It feels, it's a Hellenistic approach. I'm sure that 2000 years ago, you're wondering if you know, someone was sculpting marble, like, can you feel the spirit of this person?
Like really going back to the roots of like the art of performance.
It is. I mean, there's an essence and an energy that has to feel right with anything that we do, right? Not just when we're looking at art or sculpture or whatever it may be. If it feels right, I mean, this goes all the way up to our makeup tests. I mean, our very first makeup tests, I think, had this same thing. And for me, the magical part about that is, you know, I only take it to a certain point, right? And then it's not actually birthed yet. Robert is then taking this and breathing life into something that for the first time I get to see be alive. And that's an amazing thing.
I love, absolutely love a collaboration. So generally speaking, sometimes it'll be an image or a reference, and sometimes it'll be the voice. So I was just kind of thinking about Jimmy Spader, kind of my overdone version of how I remember him when I met him back in the 80s. And I was thinking a little bit about Gene Hackman and what a weird mashup that was. And once I gave those basic references, and then Vincent was saying something about, I go, I wonder if this guy was kind of like a wrestler, so maybe you should have a, or was it director Park who said the cauliflower ear, or was it you, Vincent?
I don't remember. I won't take credit for that.
Okay. Well, anyway, see, that's the cool thing is by the time no one's remembering whose idea anything was, that's the zone to be in for creation. And then, of course, it was, you know, just how do you make this tolerable? And what I kept finding is that Vincent was always thinking with two hats. One was, how can we make this the most realistic? And B, how can we make this not feel like someone's doing a makeup job and also not have it take so much time that it's eating into the energy that I would need for the performance?
If we think about this as a whole, these are a lot of characters and a lot of looks to go through on a daily basis, and sometimes swapping, right? Where it's like, we've got to get him out of something very quickly. We got to get him into something very quickly. So as a designer, that is part of my job, is to think about how is this most efficiently going to work. And then at the same time, know that they're at some point going to play against each other and make sure that they feel different enough that they are all their own unique characters. I mean, it is a daunting task for sure when you look at it that way.
So I had a 2-hour timer. He was like, well, I think we'll probably need for this one, maybe 3. This one could be under 2. This one, I mean, depending, the first time might be, you know, 2:40. And I was like, you got 2 hours for each. And the great thing was, I don't know why I said it. I just knew that my sanity could wrap its arms around showing up and being in a chair for the first 2 hours of any workday. Over time, regardless of if we had to, you know, switch after lunch or whatever. So
what came first, right? The chicken or the egg? Was it the physical persona? Was it the voices? Or was it like just the vibe of the character and in terms of bringing each of them to life?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I don't think I had heard the voices until after I had blocked in the sculptures. And then all of a sudden things started clicking to me and they made me want to make little changes. Like I remember the first time I heard the professor's voice, I was like, oh, wait a second. I watched the way Robert held his mouth, and there was a very particular way that he would hold his mouth. And I went, oh, I really want to enhance that jowly bit there.
See, now I understand why, because you were watching. And then all of a sudden there was this thing about the earlobes. Like you just thought that maybe Professor Hammer should have these kind of like luscious lobes. And I was just going with it, and he was going with it. And I think that Director Park would make his amendments, and he was kind of conducting the whole affair, but he could see that we were in this kind of rhythm and dialogue with each other, and he largely let it go uninterrupted unless he had a strong feeling about it.
True. Yeah. And then the amazing part about that is that when that strong feeling happened, to Director Park's, you know, unbelievable eye, it was always spot on. You would look at that and go, oh wow, yeah, that's not a note that I would ever blink an eye at. That is absolutely right.
So for the congressman, I was thinking a little bit about Charlton Heston and Eastwood and Ronald Reagan. And
Right. And
I just know that voice. So then, you know, Van Dyke was like, you know, if you're going to do contacts here, you can do them so dark that they almost start looking like sci-fi, like a soulless cipher. And I was like, put the soulless contacts in my eyes. And I didn't have to do much past that point because there was nothing ever registering that could discern that this character had a soul.
Yeah, no soul could penetrate those eyes.
I loved it. Oh my goodness.
And then, you know, I had a whole bunch of different ideas for the auteur. And the truth be told was Susan said, he's a kind of version of you of what would happen if you were left unchecked and you didn't have good people around you keeping you from turning into a complete egomaniac. And I was like, okay, well, that'll be easy. And then I wound up playing that role very much a mirror into kind of a cautionary tale, but also being able to allow myself to think like an auteur, whatever that means. And that was very freeing. And so a lot of that came down to just the hair and the little mole. I mean, obviously he's got, you know, has got quite a set of features on him. But Susan said, can we just have one of these characters look kind of sexy just for me? Just sexy enough to not be like, yuck. And I was like, oh yeah, no problem.
Little chest hair and we're good to go.
Oh my God, dude. I'll never forget the first time Van Dyke slathered that chest wig on me.
Oh my goodness. As the jean shorts come on. That might be a spoiler for episode four.
You're not far off.
Right. Yeah, that let's not bury the lead on what kind of shorts I'm wearing.
Right. For Vincent, I mean, at the end of episode three, we have all of the characters. Your busts come to life at the table eating steak with the captain. I mean, what was that? Can you walk us through what that was like for you? Did it do you justice? Did it do your work justice?
I think I'm the worst critic of my own stuff. So, I mean, I look at everything and I'm constantly trying to figure out how things can improve and be better. But that moment is a pretty cool moment. I mean, it's pretty daunting when all of these characters are against one another. Individually, a character can work really well, but it's like the minute you start comparing these different identities and then still try and lose Robert at the same time against all of them, that I think was the most nerve-wracking for me in terms of just that overall aesthetic of each character. And look, I think, again, to Robert's credit, that's why it works. You have somebody who completely transforms without the makeup for each one of those individuals. I'm just there to kind of help push them over the edge.
Well, I mean, long and short of it is it was like our wedding weekend. Like Vincent and I had to really put ourselves to task, and credit where it's due. Director Park made those 2 days where we started as one character in the morning, next the afternoon. Was the last we did, do you remember the order we did them in?
I don't.
I know that it was done for practicality about what would be the easier to transist from after morning
until
lunch.
Yeah, no, we talked a lot
lunch.
About that. Yeah, we talked a lot about how that would stagger.
Yeah, I know that we did the professor last because you knew by then I'd be losing my marbles and at least to not have to wear a wig would be cool. But it really was this thing where, again, Director Park was so prepared and so in command of exactly what he knew he would need that he was also able to really push me to make sure that I was demonstrating enough variety in each character, but also manage the time and also keep the energy up. And you know, Hua that day too, because that was rough. I mean, he had to basically do the scene, you know, four times over 2 days. So he's just such a great scene partner. So, you know, but I had a feeling, Van Dyke, after we got over the hump of that day, I was like, okay, there may be some tough days ahead, but we kind of got over the crucible. And I think we started to relax a little bit after that.
I agree. I mean, that for me, I think was the goal point of like, okay, if we can get through those days, then we can kind of get through everything.
I think another interesting part that shows through the distinctions between each of the characters is the way in which they're also satirical or criticize or subvert different expectations that we have for who these characters are. Could y'all talk a little bit about that, how it came up in the design process and in the implementation or the acting as well?
Sure. I mean, I'll do a short version. To me, Claude was someone who, he's kind of our main touch point with our hero, with the captain. And so I feel like he's the one that needed to have the biggest arc, but I also wanted to be someone who you feel like he has taken lives with his bare hands. So we did things that were subtle. Like I had some, you know, like some muscle packs over mine. Was there anything about Claude that really stood out to you as far as what he needed to represent and mean and do, Vincent?
I suppose I really felt strongly about him having this kind of tough guy look that didn't necessarily go hand in hand with his persona as a whole.
Right. Because then he's hiding in plain sight.
Right.
Later.
Right. There's a weird balance there that felt like we wanted to make sure he had this kind of ruggedness to him. But then there's also this kind of soft side too.
Yeah, exactly. The dangerous everyman. With the professor, I had a hairdresser back when I did Less Than Zero, who's, I just loved his voice so much, and he was a great, great personality, but the professor really does need to represent more of this kind of like wanton cultural appropriation. Is there anything about this guy that is appropriate, and yet he's convinced that he has the last word on the Oriental perspective. I mean, that was a rough one to even like pretend I could get behind this guy sometimes. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to make him charming enough and also just a slightly bit more elevated in the kind of lack of subtlety. Mm. Mm. Vince?
Yeah, I agree. There were some choices there that may have been even a little more bold than some of the others. I mean, his snaggletooth and teeth were, you know, a character all of their own. Yeah. The stomach is, oh my God.
On to the congressman, starting with teeth. I have never had a bigger set of chiclets in my mouth that looked like they possibly could have been real and were very much like those kind of 70s, 80s veneers that I remember seeing before we figured out how to do them correctly.
Right.
And he, to me, was a lot of that kind of, again, like I said, the archetype of the, you know, take this weapon from my cold, dead hands type thing. While at the same token, being completely out of touch with the very people he was saying he was a proponent of. So there was some stuff there, but I don't know, Vince, we always seem to have extra fun on the congressman days.
Yeah, I don't know if we ever spoke to each other in regular voices on congressman days. we're just always as congressmen.
Mm. Yeah.
A lot of that.
And meanwhile, to the auteur, I feel some of it was like Susan had said, let's at least not have him be such a caricature that you just feel like it's just a send up, you know, like a Tropic Thunder level send up of a idiot Hollywood type. I really want to think of him as an artist. And so I think part of that was, you know, Vincent really just trying to make him look like someone who had some sort of creative authority, I guess.
Yeah, it's a weird one to verbalize because I think that you have the idea of what that is, I suppose, in your head, and then you start to put it together and somehow it works for me. It gives me the essence of this very artsy, fartsy kind of guy that, you know, is a wine connoisseur and oil paints at night.
Mm. My last question for you all before we wrap is for Robert, if you had a favorite one to play throughout the series and Vincent, which one was your favorite to create? Mm.
I'll just say for the record this one time that Claude was critical because he's the one that you really carry through his relationship with the captain the whole time. All of these characters were in service of Viet's novel and of director Park's vision and of supporting Hua Shunde, who is the star. So because we kind of started and ended there, I'll go with Claude.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Claude certainly had the most amount of pressure. And I think the journey that Claude took to even land where he landed was the most challenging out of all of them. I mean, maybe in that sense, the most rewarding. But I think I maybe had the most fun on Professor Days.
Thank you.
I did. Thank you both for joining us.
Hey, this was great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, we're going to go deeper into the episode here with two of our regular guests that I've been wanting to get together. Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sympathizer, Viet Thanh Nguyen, and executive producer and co-showrunner, Don McKellar. Welcome back, Viet Thanh Nguyen and Don McKellar. Viet, my first question is for you today. In episode 3, we become a little bit more entrenched in the comings and goings of what America is for both the Vietnamese refugees who are resettling and adjusting to their new life, and then their interactions with these different folks like the congressman. Viet, for those types of interactions or how the refugees felt, did that translate well from your book into the show? Because, I mean, there was a moment that I kind of honed in on when the congressman presents the crepulent major's mother, who's played by the illustrious Go Kyu-jin, with a knife, right? And there's this moment where it's like, ooh, you know, it's very Vietnamese-American, Vietnamese cultural subtext-y. Mm. So
when I was growing up, the places where I most felt my Vietnamese refugee identity outside of my family was in the church, Catholic church, where I grew up, was in the pho restaurants, which is referenced throughout the TV series and the novel, of course, and in Chinese wedding banquets for Vietnamese weddings. So you get married in a Vietnamese Catholic church, but you always go to a Chinese wedding banquet. And a Chinese wedding banquet is like full of people, very crowded, loud band, all this kind of stuff. And it was translated in the adaptation, the TV series, into a longevity party. And I was there actually for the shoot over 3 days, and I was an extra. I actually got a speaking line. And to me, just seeing that all recreated was so amazing. It was like living through an extremely long Chinese wedding banquet in this Chinese restaurant in Los Angeles. The innovation, one of the innovations that Don did in this shoot, however, was having the character of the congressman give a knife, which actually is not in the novel. So maybe Don can talk more about that.
I mean, we thought, we had a lot of Vietnamese writers in the room, as you know, and we were talking about gifts that are given at these longevity parties. These longevity, I mean, some one of you should explain.
Were y'all in the back room just thinking, what is the most offensive thing that we could bring into this party?
Well, first of all, I think one thing that makes Vietnamese culture different perhaps from American culture is we don't usually have birthdays.
Yeah.
Like, I torment my children who are 4 and 10 by saying, I have only had one birthday party in my entire life. And they're like, oh, don't tell that story again. But typically you get sort of a birthday party, and then you get like an 80th birthday party. Like, congratulations, you survived for a while. And right. Congratulations, you made it to 80.
Because everyone's birthday is sort of on the new year.
Right.
Like, the sort of
that's
concept.
That's a big celebration.
So, right. So, which is beautiful, which is something really nice about this 80-year-old birthday party. And we thought, that's perfect occasion. In the book, like Viet says, it's a wedding. But we thought that this was a really unique aspect of Vietnamese culture. It'd be fun. And then we, you know, when we decided to introduce the congressman character, what could he do? Then, of course, we wanted something inappropriate. So I can't remember who came up with the idea of the actual knife, but by the way, I have to say that Viet is the photographer at the party. I have to say this because he said he has a cameo and people might wonder. I know he now he's going to tell the backstory.
Is this
of
your first
character.
Opportunity acting?
Yeah, and I just got paid for it, by the way. I got a check from my agent. I was like, what was this for? Oh, it's for this little one-line role, which was not planned. I had a cameo, but I wasn't actually expected to speak.
Right.
But I think Park Chan-wook gave me a line.
He wanted you to have a line, of course.
But the backstory, Don, is that I had asked repeatedly to be killed in this TV series. Why didn't you allow me to
be killed?
I wanted to be blown up. I thought the author of the book really has to be blown up.
We just didn't have a great part of someone getting blown up. Lots of people get blown up, but we just didn't want you in the background getting blown up.
That's kind of like a negative meta. If we have the author who talks about how Vietnamese people and, you know, in the mythology of movie making get blown up, be the one that's actually blown up.
That's the whole point, right? Philip. Yes.
But I guess we wanted in the meta sense for you to be the guy framing the picture, mm-hmm. the guy, you know, making us all smile. That's who we wanted.
I'm sorry about that.
We'll look you up next time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're also talking about, I think the line that you have is about a disco ball, too.
Nah, it was not called a disco ball.
That's right.
This is where Don's historical research paid off.
That's right. At the time, disco ball came in a couple. This is, of course, the beginning of the disco era, but they had the balls. We researched that, but they didn't. What year did I tell you that the actual disco ball?
79, I think.
A couple years later.
Terminology,
So what did we call it?
Yeah, I'm trying
mirror ball.
Mirror ball. That's right. Mirror ball.
Mm. Could y'all talk a little bit about the Watchmen?
Yeah, so I invented the Watchmen, not Don. I wanted to have a scene, you know, so the captain in Vietnam is a part of this special branch with secret police. And obviously part of what they do is catch so-called terrorists, in this case, Viet Cong, and interrogate them. And I did research, and there really were obviously Viet Cong attacks in Saigon and other cities where, you know, grenades and bombs and so on would be used to kill Americans and South Vietnamese military, but also a lot of innocent civilians. And so I created a character who was basically the bomb maker, called him the Watchman because he sets off his bombs with watches. And then I had to fill in that character. He's a minor character, but he plays a very important role in the book because he gives this very philosophical, pointed critique of the South Vietnamese regime and also the United States. And he puts the captain into an impossible situation because technically they're on the same side since the captain is a communist spy. But of course, the captain is also, he also has to perform the interrogation under the gaze of Claude. So there's hopefully a lot of tension.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the egg, if I was to say, it sort of represents the captain's complicity in this. In a way, this episode is sort of a parody of the classic immigrant story about joining the club, like Scarface or Godfather, where the young man has to join criminal organization, and to do that is to prove himself by committing a murder or something like that. The captain has to do that here. He's sort of seen himself as when he was in Vietnam during the war, he saw himself as sort of apart from the front line. You know, he was responsible for actions that resulted in death, but he didn't do it himself. So in the whole, this episode is really about the captain of overcoming his resistance to murder, overcoming his guilt, and accepting his complicity in the war, which is kind of what Claude wants him to understand with the Watchmen episode. So that's sort of what allows him to enter the club. He has to dress as a white man and kill someone.
Also, I mean, usually food, when it appears in these kinds of stories, often is a metaphor for identity, right?
Yeah.
So usually it's a banana, yellow on the outside, white on the inside. It's reversed with the egg. And of course, it just speaks to the captain being a mixed race character who's always being criticized from both sides, and he can't win no matter what.
There are also several highlights or spotlights on women in this episode, particularly the way in which women interact with our captain in his sort of coming of age and his uncovering of his sexuality and sexual identity and his own sense of masculinity, particularly as it relates to, we mentioned tension earlier. The tension between him and Sonny happens in this episode too, particularly as it relates to Miss Maury. Could you share a little bit about what that tension was like? Because we, from the novel, Sonny is one of the captain's rivals, right? So how do we start understanding that between them?
When I created the character of Ms. Maury, it was very important for me to make her an older Asian American woman, because if you read the novel, I mean, like, the captain is a very masculine guy, and he's probably a little too masculine. The book is at least partly a deconstruction of his own masculine and sexual obsessions that he himself is not aware of. And so early on in the novel, he's looking at very young women and so on. And so when he gets to the United States, I thought it would just be much more interesting that it didn't repeat that pattern, but that he had to encounter someone more mature, more cynical, older, and so on, more knowing. And her character obviously will develop over the course of the entire series and book. So she's, you know, a very powerful character, I hope. And Sandra really just plays her amazingly as well. And yeah, and then, you know, Sonny comes in, you have a love triangle, you have to sort of wait for a few more episodes to see the permutations of both the romantic and political angles of this triangle.
Yeah. I mean, I think, as Viet says, he's sort of playing like a 70s masculine movie star, like Steve McQueen side of character. And the Ms. Maury character isn't the expected love interest for that character. But we really like the idea that because of social pressure, the major's mother says, bring a date. Why aren't you married? You know, like he's sort of pressured into making this relationship more than he expected, more than Ms. Maury was initially promising. It was initially supposed to be free love. And now all of a sudden they are a couple coming out socially. Yeah, well, we'll see what happens with that as the series continues.
Love it or leave it is a phrase that comes up often in episode 3. You evoke the phrase or mention the phrase love it or leave it often. It's something that comes up in your work and in the speeches that you give in public. How has this phrase been part and partial to your own experience of becoming American as a Vietnamese refugee here in the United States? And at the end of this particular episode, it's uttered by the ghost of the major who gets killed.
I think anybody who's not white in the United States has heard the phrase love it or leave it uttered to them. And it's obviously a very offensive phrase for many reasons, but it also is an expression of ownership of the United States. Whoever gets to say love it or leave it thinks they own this country and they want to determine who is a part of it and who isn't. And they also want to erase the entire history of the country, which was about white people coming here and taking it over so that they could say love it or leave it. And so I think much of my work is a critique of that, both at a political level, but also at a, you know, entertainment level, literary level, personal level. And so, you know, obviously I wanted to make that central to the novel. I also think about the fact that my own parents never said love it or leave it to me. So the other place where you would hear that phrase is within a family. If you're a rebel for whatever reason, you can get kicked out of your family. And that certainly has happened in Vietnamese refugee families. So the captain struggles with that too, that, you know, he's always an outsider no matter where he's at. It's always being expected of him that he fully love whatever side or community that he's supposed to be a part of. And he's always under suspicion. So that's one reason why I think it becomes a major thematic in episode three. Don should answer why the crappy old major
says it.
It's
on stickers. It's also the last line of this episode.
Yeah, so I said, I mean, as you say, we got it from the book, but I guess we thought it was particularly powerful and ironic because, of course, these people loved their country and had to leave it. You know, they had to leave almost because they loved the country. So it's so inappropriate and, as Via says, sort of offensive to this community. But we love the idea that the captain sees this when he's trying to think of how to get away with this murder of the major. He thinks that the best solution is to disguise it as a racist murder, a racially motivated murder. In other words, by dressing white and killing someone in a presumably racially motivated way, that is the best way to hide in America. So it just seems like such a delicious irony that I think we wanted the major to rub that in at the end of the episode.
Can you speak a little bit more about that, Don? You know, the theme of, you know, sneaking around betrayal comes up, wearing this mask or being disguised, and even being disguised in plain sight is one of the sort of the major themes in this episode.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, again, I feel a little self-conscious talking about this in front of Viet, who wrote a book about Man of Two Faces and so on. The captain is always sort of wearing a mask. That's the way he always sees himself. It's sort of essential to his identity crisis that's right there from the beginning. But he recognizes, even in the first episode, when Claude can hide in plain sight, even in a city where he stands out like a sore thumb, even in Saigon, where majority of people are Vietnamese, he still somehow can disappear. And that's sort of the sort of magic blessing of his whiteness and a sort of sense of entitlement that he assumes that he belongs anywhere and can get away with anything. And the captain recognizes that right from the beginning. And so, I don't know, he hasn't really thought this through that carefully, but I think when he wants to commit a murder, he wants to hide, he sort of dresses like a white man and commits a racially motivated crime. So yeah, it's disguise. Yeah, disguising and disguising yourself is one of the major themes. And of course, that sort of ties in with the multiple Roberts too. They're all sort of the same person in disguise in a sense, in a sort of meta sense anyway.
And then for Viet, how do we make sense of the captain and his sort of conflictedness around these different acts of betrayal, perhaps on an institutional level, to an interpersonal level, to an individual level in himself?
I think that the captain understands that betrayal takes place most powerfully at the level of countries, states, ideologies. And part of the political narrative of the novel is certainly that ideologies have been betrayed. You know, the Americans have betrayed their own belief systems. The French betrayed their belief systems. The South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese and the communists and the anti-communists, they all have belief systems and they all betrayed them at some point. And someone like the captain, who is a living embodiment of the East and the West as a mixed race French Vietnamese person, is the embodiment of betrayal, because he's constantly being betrayed by his own countrymen, whatever their color. And he is seen by everyone else as a potential traitor because no one can trust him because he's not pure. And so that's a major motif that runs throughout the novel and certainly the TV series, that the captain is constantly grappling with these elements of betrayal within himself, in his own actions, the actions of states. So he's being forced into these acts of betrayal, but he also chose them because he chose to become a spy. I mean, if you choose to become a spy, you know you're going to have to do stuff that's probably going to be morally suspect, no matter if it's politically required or not. And so that's part of the drama for the captain and for the TV series, is how does someone who thinks he's doing good end up doing what is, you know, bad, even if his victims themselves may not be uncomplicated as well, as we'll discover with the crapulent major by the end of the series.
Thank you so much to Viet and Don for joining us today on the podcast, and we'll see you very soon.
Thank you. It was really fun.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Philip. Loved it.
And that's a wrap for us today. Many thanks to Robert Downey Jr., Hua Shande, Vincent Van Dyke, Viet Thanh Nguyen, and Don McKellar for joining us today. We'll see y'all again next time when we dive into episode 4 about movies and myth-making with costume designer Danny Glicker, along with returning guests Don McKellar and Viet Thanh Nguyen. stream new episodes of the HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, Sundays, exclusively on Max. And subscribe and listen to the podcast after every episode of the show on Max and wherever you get your podcasts. The Sympathizer podcast is produced by the Mashup Americans for HBO.